Today is September 15th, 1993. This is Margaret Van Cleve. I will be interviewing Marie Haggard, a pioneer Alaskan and longtime resident of Fairbanks. This tape is made possible by a grant from Igloo No. 4 Foundation, Pioneers of Alaska. We are recording in Mrs. Haggard's home in downtown Fairbanks. Okay, you mentioned that your mother hiked the Chilkoot Pass and your father came north via Dyea in one of our earlier conversations. As a daughter of the Gold Rush, so to speak, what are some of your earliest memories of early days in Fairbanks and also some of the things your parents may have told you about their experiences?
My mother was very deeply emotional, you might say, about coming to this great country, and the Gold Rush was something that permeated the whole feeling of the Northwest in the continent. They were aware of Alaska, and my folks were among those who came to Alaska first in 98. My mother came up in 1898 over the Chilkoot Pass with her mother, stepfather, her two sisters and a brother. And they went through all the passages that were encountered by any who wanted to pursue this great country. They had no conveniences whatsoever, and the detail on this is something beyond description. I regret that I didn't get a tape of my own mother's and my dad's stories of their coming up, but the highlights of it, I can certainly give the feeling of what it was to come to Alaska over the rough and rugged trails.
So they went to Dawson probably first.
They went to Dawson. They went over the Chilkoot the day after the big slide, and they helped exhume some of the bodies.
Oh, the April slide.
Yes. And it was in the early spring, I believe, or late spring, however that worked in. And she was just a young girl then, and of course very impressionable, and everything meant the world to her. I might say that they went down the Yukon from the headwaters of the Yukon in one of those barges, which was very precarious.
If they
tipped or dumped, well, that was the end. There was no halfway. Your life wasn't recovered. And mother would tell me a few stories about what happened here and there. I don't recall all of them, but her experiences were much like a Wild West story. In saloons, when not that she drank, but she did have to, by necessity, be in those places, and without fail, there was somebody with a 45 or having an argument, and it was usually settled at the point of a gun. But she fortunately didn't witness anybody being eliminated. My daddy came up to Alaska over the Dyea Trail by way of Nome, and then came to Fairbanks from Nome. I don't remember how he got to Fairbanks, unless he mushed the whole way or came by boat. The old Alameda boat from the Alaska Steamship Company was the one that seemed to ply most frequently between the Northwest, that is the Seattle ports, Washington ports, and Nome. And it was the first boat into Nome in the spring, if I remember right, with fresh produce and things that people were without for many months in the past. And I think that's the way Dad went to Nome. But anyway, he wound up in Fairbanks in the early 1900s, 1901 or 2. I'll back up on that. He came to Alaska in 1902, but he wound up in Fairbanks around 1908, 7 or 8, where he met my mother, and they were married in Dome City, which is a short distance from Fairbanks. It doesn't exist anymore. You can't even see where Dome City was now.
Pretty overgrown by brush.
It's on Dome Creek. And I after I was born, my folks, of course, Dad came up for mining, and mining was in his blood, and he settled on a claim, a creek claim, on Dome Creek, about 20 miles.
So were you born in Dome or in Fairbanks?
No, I was born in Fairbanks.
At the old hospital?
At the old hospital that's now gone.
Oh, the Episcopal.
Catholic hospital.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I understand
old,
there were
that
two.
That old building has been demolished. They said it was a fire trap, but it no, it lasted for I don't know
yeah,
how many years.
Yeah, here after the flood.
Yeah. Oh my.
It's
yes.
1967.
Yeah, long after the flood.
What were your parents' names?
My mother's name was Smith. See, what was my grandfather's name? James Smith.
And her first name?
And my mother's name is Margaret. Margaret Smith Quirk, when she was married.
And your father was...
And Thomas Henry Quirk.
Quirk.
And they lived for the whole time prior after I was born on Dome Creek until I became of school age. And of course on Dome Creek he was mining. He had two claims there and they operated as they did in those days with the shafts and the windlass and the sluice boxes and the cleanup periods and the big boiler house and all that sort of thing. And I had Dad had a little dog team of six dogs that he used to haul wood for the furnace to keep things going for the steam to run the hoist and all that sort of thing. They didn't use gasoline. They used the I don't know how they applied it, but at any rate, the big boiler was used in the boiler house. And the dogs were, of course, I was always, as a little kid, I was crazy about dogs. And all animals. So, they Daddy got me a dog that I love very much. I called her Innie, Injun, her name was, and she was with me wherever I went. And when she died, there was a gentleman who was associated with Daddy, George Robbins. He was a very nice man, a family friend, and miner, and I asked for my dog one day, and he said, "Innie is no more. Innie died." And I wanted to know where she was, and he said, "She fell down an old shaft," and that didn't make me happy at all. I was a little tiny girl, about 4 years old, and I knew that that wasn't very good, and I remember crying and crying, my mother trying to console me. So the years went by, and I had, as a child, I had a happy life there. We picked blueberries, and Dad hunted grouse, and for the most part, we lived off the land for as far as meat was concerned. Once in a while, a moose would come through, and that's the way our sustenance was.
There were other families out there, too, with
yes,
children?
Yes, not right close. We were about... I guess about a mile from Olness, a little town of Olness.
Oh, sure.
And Olness was quite a big town. There's nothing there now to speak of. I mean, the buildings that are there now weren't there then. But it had a cigar store, and there was a narrow gauge railroad came from Fairbanks to Olness and served there and made a circle around toward Chattanooga and then back into Fairbanks again. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I don't know if it did that every day or not, but it was frequently enough. And they had, I think, two or three banks. It was quite an active little place. And as a little girl, Dad worked in a cigar store when he wasn't busy with the mine. And I'd go down there and sing songs for... There's a little kid, and the men would give me 25 cents for every song.
Oh, that was good pay in those days.
Yeah, that was good pay. So the years went by, and I became a school age, and we moved into town.
Was that the situation, I guess, with most people, that there were no schools out there?
Oh, no, there was no school there.
So
no,
usually no, people no, would move into no. town later
on? No, I was about six. I would have been, in November that starting year, I'd been seven. So actually, I was 7 years old when I started school. And I went through grammar school and high school and the University of Alaska. I graduated from the University of Alaska in 36. I had 2 years of my grammar school were outside, as they say. It's kind of a colloquial term for the lower 48. I went to school in Yakima, Washington, and Seattle in second grade. In fifth grade, I was went to school in Yakima and in Colorado, Gunnison, Colorado. Other than that, all my schooling education was here in Fairbanks.
And your first school would have been that building on Cushman Street that had the
old with the bell on the top.
Yes,
that's the one.
That burned in 1932 or so.
Was that the year it was? I remember very well. It was a Sunday morning, I think, when it burned. I think.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. And I believe Alaska Link, Lasta Stewart, she was then, rescued the bell, or I think she has the bell. I'm not sure. Do you know?
No, I haven't heard that
story.
Well,
somebody has the old bell that was in that school.
Yeah, that's in a lot of old photographs of Fairbanks.
Yeah, I have a
three-story school.
Nice photograph of that old school, special one.
Well, what are some of the highlights of Fairbanks' social life as you remember as a child in terms of activities?
Well, there were wonderful days. I wouldn't trade my life in Fairbanks with anybody in the world that I know of, even today, and looking in retrospect, I wouldn't. Everybody knew what everybody else was doing, and there was usually one event on Saturday night, and everybody went to it. If they wanted to go anywhere, they'd go to that event, whether it's a dance or a special program that was put on. We had what they called the tombola that was put on every year, I think by the Catholic Church, I'm not sure, to raise money. And they interviewed and auditioned different ones in Fairbanks to take part in that. Mm-hmm. I have a picture of one of the tombola casts. There must have been about 40 in it. And they bring up a producer who would have a theme. For instance, one theme was a Hawaiian theme. I think it was called Hello Hawaii. and we all had particular parts in that. That's just one of many things. There'd be high school plays there'd be a recital, and we had a full life, and it was wholesome. And we had one policeman in town. I can't think of the first policeman that I knew about. I wish I could think of his name. My dad knew him well. The next one, when I was in grammar school and high school, was Austin Gibbs. He was a very slight little man, very nice, and he was the only policeman in town. the kids weren't mean, but they were full of catch and jammer tricks.
Yeah, probably it's Halloween.
And this Halloween,
busy night for him.
This Halloween, that they caught Mr. Gibbs and put him in somebody's outhouse that they put on top of a truck and put him on the school grounds, locked him in the outhouse for a while. And nobody was hurt. He just did that kind of a
off duty for the night.
Little trick. But we had lots of wholesome good times. And as far as school life was concerned, we had full activities. We didn't have some of the curricula that they now have, I guess, and vast assortment of plays and music and so forth. But we did always had a music teacher for the school. Mm-hmm. We had chorus group, a choral group. And I usually wound up by playing for him instead of singing, because I was the only one who could play.
Yeah, I guess music was really very important in early, certainly is now, it was even
then. And
over
the years, my folks started me in music when I was, I was about 11 years old, I guess, with Mr. Gobraw. His picture was in the paper in the Heartland this last time. Did you notice the Heartland? I think it showed this old band, this group of old timers. I knew most of them, but it was a 1912 picture, mm-hmm. kind of before my time to know who they were. But in those years went by, I knew who they were, and he was the band leader. He played the trumpet.
I just see they're trying to start up another community band now.
Are they?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. We had things like that going. We weren't just holed up in igloos. We had lots of activity, and it was genuine. And the Saturday night dances were always, I don't think I ever missed a Saturday night dance.
Now, where were those held? In the old Eagles?
Either the Moose Hall, that was down on Wickersham, is it? It's that big vacant lot next to that little restaurant. Right, you know where Rosamond Weller lived? Little pink house. Right across from her was the Moose Hall. And it was quite a versatile building. It was set up as a movie place. I mean, it had a stage and it had screens or settings that they could drop down for some kind of scenery, for plays and whatnot. And they had, it had a regular, formal, professional stage.
Hmm.
Nice big hall. It was kind of a rickety building. It had been there for heavens knows how long. And then they had, it had a back area above the pool room in the back, which they could use for a dining room or the entertainment or whatever, mm-hmm. Different clubs meeting. And the other place that if they didn't have a dance there, they'd have one at the Eagles Hall, which was torn down about 8 or 9 years ago. Mm-hmm. It was on the corner of Cushman and Fifth Avenue.
Oh, yes, I remember that.
It was a kind of a nice building.
Mm-hmm. A landmark.
Yeah.
It's now gone.
It had a lot of goodies to it, too. Mm-hmm. I can think of, we had experiences here that they didn't have in the lower 48. We had important flyers come up here, airplane pilots who, I can't think of his name. He came up with, there was a squadron, they called them the Black Wolf Squadron. Four airplanes, I think I'm right about that, and there were Captain Street was the commander. It was Army or Air Force, either Air Force
what,
or Army.
About what year would that be?
In the 1920s.
In the 20s.
I don't know what year, but I was a kid, grammar school kid.
And so, yeah, you can gauge
And they
it
landed
that.
At Weeks Field. They didn't even call it Weeks Field then, they called it the ballpark. And they had these funny little airplanes that they flew so many thousands of miles. And there's a... then, of course, Wiley Post came through, and that was years later. And Howard Hughes. And I knew Ben Ileson. He taught in high school for a while, but he wasn't a good teacher. His mind was on flying. And Noel Ween, I knew when he came up here in, I think, 1924 or 25. Mm-hmm.
So you knew these people were probably friends of your parents or neighbors?
Well, everybody knew everyone else. And somewhere along the way you meet them. You say hello to them whether you know them or met them or not. I remember years ago when I was in Nome, when I was working for the Territorial Veterans. I was up there. I was regional director for them for a while, and I was over there making loans for the territory to veterans. And I had never been in Nome before. And I always have remembered this, just walking down the street, people I'd never seen before. They'd smile, a warm smile, and say hello. You don't see that anymore. Mm-hmm. Even in Fairbanks, it's gone, by the way.
I guess you lose it when you reach a certain population size.
But not like it used to be. Just like putting out their arms to you and welcoming mm-hmm. you. They didn't know me from Adam's old fox. So those are the little things that I remember that are so warm. And And I remember when Howard Hughes came, he was dressed in his usual way when he flew, as a formal hat and his black suit. And he threw out a lot of, he'd just come across the ocean from the west, I think, and was going to be heading down into the lower states. And he had unloaded all these golf balls, would they have been, for float? Light, are golf balls light?
Wait. No. But something about that size?
Yeah, a lot of small balls. I don't remember what it was.
I guess that was before the days
for
of
For flotation, in case he got forced down in the in the ocean. And he was very, very strict and gruff in speaking to those helping him get his plane gassed up and whatnot. And when he took off, he was so heavy loaded with gas, he just barely got the end of the runway and barely lifted it up and got up to the altitude.
This would have been from the ballpark.
Yeah, the ballpark yeah.
Where the library is now, or about.
In that area,
in
yeah.
that area,
Wheatsfield. The old Pan American hangar is there yet, where all those stores are. In the lower part, there's some. Whenever you go into that building, it seems to me I've had to go downstairs, like the dressmaker is down there, and mm-hmm. then there's a sporting goods deal on the other end of it. It's the old, what's left of the old Pan American mm-hmm. hangar.
Go ahead.
After I graduated, I thought, well, I'd like to take it easy. I don't want to do anything now, and I couldn't stand it. I had to get a job, so I went down and asked Noel Ween if he had a position for him. He said, sure. He said, come on in tomorrow, something like that. So that was my first job, and then I was offered jobs after that. I worked for E.B. Collins and Julian Hurley, one in the morning and the other in the afternoon. One was Julian Hurley was a trial attorney, and I guess that's what you would call him. He liked court cases where he could be brilliant. He was a brilliant attorney. And the other one was E.B. Collins, who was an estates attorney for the most part, drew up estates and papers for handling of property, leases, and so mm-hmm. forth. And then I was offered a job by Dr. Bunnell as his secretary, and I was his secretary for 4 years.
Oh, and when was that, in the 30s?
That was 1938-1942.
Oh, I bet you have a lot of stories about Dr. Bunnell. He was quite
a
character.
He was
a good boss to work for?
Hmm?
Was he a good boss?
Yes, he was. He was. I liked him very much. Very much. he was a very fine man. He helped more young people. Whether it was before the days where they could just ask for a loan and get it.
Yeah, the student loan.
He'd take it out of his pocket.
Student loan was him.
expect them to be paid back, but most of the time he didn't get paid back. But he didn't care if it did some good. Resigned from there because I was offered a real good job with Pan American as express accountant. It was sort of a clerk accounting, really. I was preparing the papers for the accountant in Seattle. And then the war started, and they moved me to Seattle, and I had a difficult time. It wasn't difficult, but it was inconvenient where I was living and having to commute to the Boeing field where their headquarters was, so I resigned and got a job with the Air Transport Command during the war. That was a very exciting job, and priorities and traffic.
Now where would you be?
And weights and balance.
Where would you be located?
Ladd Field. Ladd Field in the big hangar. That was a very exciting job, and I met lots of famous people who came up, entertainers for the most part.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah,
who were some of them that you remember?
And, there was Kay Francis and Ingrid Bergman and Bob Hope, Bing Crosby.
Oh, you didn't need to go to Hollywood. They all came up here.
I got the autographs from some of those people. I can't think of it. And the Russian leader then was here too, but he was under heavy guard, and he didn't leave the officer's quarters until he went to his airplane. Who was the Russian leader during World War II?
Stalin?
No.
Oh, you mean the military person?
No, the communist leader, the head of the Russian. I can't think of his name now.
Yeah, I think Stalin was the
Khrushchev.
Was the chairman then during the Second World War?
He was the head man in Russia.
So he came over.
Mm-hmm.
He came to Ladfield.
Yes, he was in Ladfield. Uh-huh. I think he was passing through. I don't know whether he met with. I think he had been somewhere. And maybe Washington. I don't know where he came from, really.
And then stopped over on the
but
way back.
He was in Ladfield for a few hours,
under, as you say, heavy guards.
You
heard about
guard.
It after
Nobody
he left.
Nobody saw him, no. Mm-hmm. I don't think they even saw him leave, except the guards. And then I got the position as offered me to be regional director for the Territorial Veterans. And I liked that very much. I'd learned a lot of legal procedure with the working for the attorneys. And I worked under Harry Palmer as the office clerk or secretary. And then he resigned, and I became the regional director for a while. And then I was offered a job in the real estate office, and I got into real estate. That's how I got into real estate.
Yes, I noticed you put that on your form, that you were into real estate.
Yeah, my business, that's where I last was at when I retired. Mm-hmm. I was in California, however, there.
Mm-hmm.
I was in real estate for altogether about 14 years. And my former husband, I was first married in 1941.
Oh, that came off. Yeah.
And, or rather, 1951. And we lived here. He was a doctor, Hubie Fate, Sr. And we lived here for about 7 years when he retired from his practice and we moved to California. And we had a horse ranch there, a thoroughbred ranch, and it was a dream of a place. It was beautiful. And of course, loving horses as I do, my husband was raising thoroughbreds, but we both had our saddle horses, and we rode with a riding club, a Western riding club, during the summer months into the Marble Mountains. It was very beautiful.
Yeah, something you didn't get in Fairbanks as a child growing up.
Yes, well,
horses
we
had
once
very
in a while.
Popular.
There was a fellow by the name of Jimmy Kane here. Everybody in Fairbanks would know him. He had two beautiful horses. He had one, I think it was American Saddlebred. It was a beautiful saddle horse. It was always in a parade, and it was very often ridden by the mayor when we had a parade, like
4th of July.
What they now call Golden Days. They call it it was in the wintertime, they called it the Ice Carnival. And then he had a Shetland pony, a little sorrel Shetland pony that we kids would get together with. And a fellow by the name of Gordon Hunter, we called him Sheeny. We couldn't take the pony unless he went with us because she was kind of salty, and
he knew how to handle her. So I have a picture of Sheenie, or Gordon, holding the pony of the cutter, and on the handlebars was Agnes Snodgrass and Margaret Carlstein, and in the cutter I was sitting. And it was up in the, on, I think it was right there by where the Presbyterian Church is now. Mm-hmm. The old Presbyterian Church was there. I just happen to remember that picture that they had.
Lots of parades in, well, Fairbanks still has a lot of parades.
Yes.
Golden Days,
well,
and of course, Labor Days.
Well, big events. Maybe it's because a different, as they say, a different bunch are getting it now. I think, well, gee, they don't have the fun they used to have, but maybe that's not so. They're probably having fun their own way. But it seemed to me that everybody in town went out to see the parade in the Ice Carnival, and the Canadians would come over and play hockey, and they had queen contests. And the Canadians participated in that. And they had floats, real nice floats in the parade. I think much nicer than they have now. More work was put into them. And they had ice events and entertainment in the Moose Hall, for example.
So everybody took part. If you weren't in the parade, you were there watching it.
Yes, well, you're watching it, and everybody just had grand time. Mm-hmm. And there were skiing events. We didn't have ski runs then, as I recall. We had runs, but there were no lifts.
Mm-hmm. By skiing,
skiing. You had to climb up the hill and then on your own power.
Half an hour of glory.
And that wasn't so much fun. That was a little bit rough, but they finally got on Birch Hill. I think they got their first rope tow, and then out on Cleary Summit they got developed a nice ski run over the years, and they had a regular chair lift there too. I just regret that I didn't get stories from both my mother and dad of their experiences. Dad was a wonderful storyteller, and he would tell about the experiences that he went through. But they went in one ear and out the other. Mm-hmm. I thought there was a kid when I would listen to them.
He didn't realize it was such an important part of history.
But they didn't have money. They were looking for gold, and they went up as best they could, hitchhiking or whatever. And I remember this tale he told. A fellow had a load of pipe and whatever wood that he needed in a vehicle that was motor driven. It was some kind of a Dodge or Ford truck going over one of the better roads, and he was trying to get, he knew where he was going, this driver, and my dad thought, well, I've got to get there somehow and I don't have the money, so he crawled in between these pipes and these logs and rode as far as this fellow went. And the man never knew he was there. He jumped off and got
out. Not exactly a comfortable ride.
Yes.
But I guess it beats walking.
Well, it was a happy time. I look back on my childhood in Fairbanks. Mm.
And I suppose there are a few people around that you grew up with who are still here in Fairbanks.
Yes, Charlotte Lynn Thomas. Did you know her?
No.
She was one of my closest friends in mid-years in high school and college. The first friends I had, one was, she just passed on this last spring, is Lucille Meath. Lucille Lavery Meath.
we started first grade together, and Agnes Herring Schlottfeldt, she and I started first grade together. And the rest of them, and Mita Bloom, the Bloom family left here, I think in their mid-high school years, and their dad took them to Europe or Ireland to finish school. They were had a very sophisticated education, and they went to the Sorbonne in France.
Oh my goodness!
In the summertime, and went to school the University of Ireland. What do they call that? In Dublin.
Trinity College in Dublin.
Yeah, in Dublin, I think. At any rate, those were the kids that I grew up with, and we had lots of fun. And we didn't have our fun wasn't set up for us. They didn't have programs for kids, ball games, and we made our own fun. If we had a ball game, we went out and got
organized
kids together
yourself,
and found a vacant lot somewhere and played ball. It wasn't all laid out for us, and we didn't have uniforms, and we didn't have an adult that was ordering us around. We just had our own clean fun.
Where did you play, up at where Weeks Field is now,
if we wanted to play ball, went in somebody's yard and did it. The yards were big. For instance, the Herrings had a big yard. And I don't recall that I played ball very much because it wasn't my cup of tea. I liked to, as years went by, I loved to play tennis. But we were there where they were having all these fun things going on.
Mm-hmm.
And the adults in Fairbanks were very solicitous about kids, hoping that they would have a good time, and seeing that order was always maintained. The only mean thing kids did, if you want to call it mean, is knock on doors and run away. You know, that
sounds pretty tame now.
That was tame naughtiness. Mm-hmm. That was not bad at all. I really can't think of anything bad that kids did in those days.
Well, I guess it was like one big family, and you just looked out for one another.
Mm-hmm. Everybody knew everybody else.
So most everyone lived in the downtown area?
There was no environs. It was just a nucleus right here, and that was it. That's why we walked everywhere. We'd put our car, Dad would put his cars up on wheels or on blocks in the wintertime, and boy, when the spring had come, that's the day Dad's going to take the car out, you know. But we walked everywhere we went, and the gals all wear mucklucks and maybe a long coat and ski pants to keep warm when we'd walk down. Our dates would walk us down to the Moose Hall. We lived on 5th and Lacey, so we didn't have too far to go. It was quite a ways, as far as if you want to walk at 60 below.
I was going to say, at 60 below, it would seem a long way.
And there
ways.
Was probably only one cab in town, and the fellas didn't have money to buy a cab fare, so they'd walk us down to the Moose Hall, and then we'd go in and take off our mucklucks. We'd carry our dancing shoes with us.
Yeah, so like we do today.
So we had good sense. We loved it all.
Yeah, I guess you had some really cold winters back then.
Well, they're not any colder than they are now.
Well, we've had some mild ones lately.
They were cold, but they were not. Didn't stop us from doing what we wanted to do. I'm always amazed at people when we travel outside and talk to people who have traveled a lot but have never gone to Alaska. They say, "What do you do up there in the wintertime? Do you go into your house and just stay there until spring?" The only way I answer those people is to say, come on up and find out. That's just what I tell them. Because it seems so ridiculous that they, actually, the climate here, all in all, is less oppressive and prohibitive than it is down south, where they have the hurricanes and tornadoes and floods. All the oppressive things that
Yeah, it's just cold here.
That stops them from, stops activity.
Mm-hmm.
Slides.
Yeah, I'd say the lower 48's had its problems this summer and winter too, so.
But our house, I look back, every time I use my washing machine and dryer, I think of my mother. She didn't have any of that equipment. I got her a washing machine when I was, just after I got started working, when I was in, finished college, and she had to wash by hand, washboard. The water was hard, mm-hmm. and I remember Dad would get, we had one of those oval brass tubs that we'd put on the stove with and put water into the hard water from the well. And then she'd put borax in that and then skim it as it got warmed up. She'd skim all that off, then the water would be soft. And she'd use that for washing clothes. She did have a mangle so she could bring them out.
Yeah.
And I think if I ever complain about anything, I ought to be ashamed. But my mother went through.
Yeah, times.
But as time went on, though, she got everything modern, and it was. E.B. Collins said, he used to brag about, he says, I had the first flush toilet in Fairbanks. Maybe he did, I don't know.
It wasn't there, most people had water delivered.
Yes.
Was it Fred the water man?
Yes, that's interesting. His name was Fred Mustard. He was a, I guess that's a sort of a Scandinavian name.
Mustard?
Mustard, S-G-J-E-R-D.
It
is Scandinavian, but I think, but I don't know. Anyway, he was a real nice gentleman. He had two big, well-cared-for horses, a black and a dappled gray. And he came by every day. If you wanted water, you put out. You were given a card. If you want one bucket or two buckets, you showed on the card,
mm-hmm.
and they'd bring you those buckets, and you'd leave him. You'd buy so many little bingles or whatever for so much for a dollar or for $5, and then if you have one bucket, you'd put out one of those buckets, and he'd pick up the bingle and a bucket of water.
Oh, so you'd...
So you didn't have to actually handle money. You bought, I say bingles, a little
cardboard
Mm-hmm. And that would be the payment for the water.
Well, that sounds like an easy bookkeeping system.
I have pictures of him in several places in town. We used to jump on his, you know how in the wintertime how the runners stick out back of the main body of the vehicle, if you've ever seen. Maybe you haven't seen that sort of thing.
No, I don't.
Well, we'd jump on those runners and ride. He didn't like that, but he...
You were faster than he was.
He kind of let us do it. Yeah. He built that house on Cowles. It's the only one like it down there. It's not far from the exit of Cowles onto where the ballpark was. It's on the left side of the road as you go southeast or southwest, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. Towards the library.
Yeah, towards the library, not far from the library. And somebody bought it, whoever bought it, built an addition on it exactly like the original.
Hmm. So is the house still there?
Yeah, it's still there.
Oh, I have to look on my way home.
Yeah, it's kind of unique because it's the only kind of architecture that's there. It's kind of a tall house, doesn't have big windows, but it's well built.
Yeah, I guess those are the oldest houses in Fairbanks now, other than the little log cabins on First Avenue.
Yeah, I remember most of all those houses, who they belong to. Big Steins. I remember. I can't remember right now. The one across. Better cut it off. While I was working for Dr. Bunnell as his secretary, it was in the summer months, and he was always very casual in his dress. He had just casual dress as he's walking about the campus looking at things, and he knew what was going on at all times, of course. And this man was a tourist who came onto the campus, and he wondered where he could find the president of the university. Dr. Bunnell said, "Well, you see that building over there? He's right on that third floor up." It was the second floor up. And he said, "Thank you very much." And meanwhile, this man walked around and went over to the gymnasium. There weren't very many buildings on the campus then, and I think he went into the lower part of the Eielson building. Meanwhile, Dr. Bunnell went into the back way. He knew where this fellow was all the time. Mm-hmm. And got up into his office and sat down in the chair, and he still has the cigar in his mouth, and he always wore a sun visor.
Oh, this is Bunnell?
And this fellow came in. He said, "Are you the president of the university?" This man. He said, "Yes, sir, I am. I'm Dr. Bunnell. Won't you have a seat?" That went on from there. That was the kind of a person he was. He was very, very direct and unpretentious, but a very brilliant man.
Yeah, really innovative in what he did to get the university going and to keep it going. So you worked as his secretary then for 4 years. This was after you graduated from the university.
Yes, I had two jobs before then. Mm-hmm. And it was all very interesting. Some famous people came through. Wilhelmer Stephenson came through.
Oh, yes, I remember reading about that. So you had a chance to talk to these people,
yes,
of course, and
yes,
set up appointments.
I always met them, and I had the opportunity to go to functions, special private functions, dinners and whatnot, as his secretary. It was a nice experience. Mm.
Went along with the job, then.
Yeah.
A nice benefit.
Yeah.
Oh.
Okay. Have you gotten me married to my husband yet?
To Harvey? Your husband Harvey? No.
I gotta say that I would come up here every summer. I knew my ties weren't severed from Alaska because my stepchildren were here. Dr. Hugh Fate and his wife Mary Jane and their three girls. So I came up every summer to visit them. And this particular summer when I came up, this man that I'm now married to, Harvey Haggard, had been widowed. And a party was given, and I was using Mary Jane's car. And I was going to church, in fact, the first time. And the car wouldn't start. It was a diesel and had some kind of a performance that had to go through before I tried to let it go, and it wasn't working. So I found out by a friend that I was to call Harvey Haggard to have him take me to church. And the same thing happened to our dinner party when it wouldn't go. So he took me to the dinner party. So that was the start of a nice romance and a reunion. I knew had known him before, mm-hmm. years before, but we were married that fall, late summer in August 1986.
And that's when you came back.
And that's when I came back here to reestablish my residency in Fairbanks in Alaska.
Yeah, I guess people who, like yourself, who were born here and grew up in Fairbanks, feel a real nostalgia for Fairbanks, and mm-hmm. you never really leave, even if you go outside to live, mm-hmm. that there's that tie that's never broken.
That's right. There's something unique about Alaskans in that area, I think. I noticed that particularly at the University of Alaska. The old-timers, most of them were, not all of them, there were a lot of young people from the East, from New England, attended the university in those years, not a lot, but relatively,
And as the years went by, people from all over came to the university, but they weren't, they'd graduate and be gone, forget all about it, and they don't bother about alumni meetings. Those attending the alumni meetings now are those from
the 20s and 30s.
In the middle time, in the back, years back, but not those who have graduated in the last 15 or 20 years don't show up.
Well, I guess you could compare it to the small town Fairbanks, that where everybody knew one another. Mm-hmm. At the university, I suppose it was the same situation that
you... Yeah, but you'd think an alumni association. Yeah. I guess it's the same thing. Harvey went to his reunion when we were out on this trip, and there was only a handful there. Of course, a lot of them are gone now, but they don't have the meetings that they used to, but...
Yeah, there is certainly a very strong alumni from the 30s, early 30s. Mm-hmm. So
he graduated in 1936, too, when I did, from the University of Missouri.
Who were some of your classmates at the University of Alaska? You said you graduated class of 36?
Yeah. There were 18 in the class. Helen Frank was one. Dick Dake. Pat Thompson. I can't think of their names. Let's see. Branica, don't ask me how to spell it. She's a Finnish girl. Paul Wickstrom. Ed Stevens.
Well, that's it. Pretty good start on them. Mm-hmm. And then, I guess the student professor ratio was about 7 students to every professor, or was certainly.
I don't know what the ratio was.
But that you would know all the teachers on the staff.
So we knew.
Well, there's one still around, Lola Tilly. Probably had her in college.
The whole school knew everybody.
Yeah, did you ever have a class from Lola Tilly?
Yes. Excuse me. I just got a frog in my throat. I would like to have this a record of my feelings toward my mother and dad for their strength and courage. And they have always been an example to me in everything that I've done. I look on what my mother and my dad did and went through in their life in Alaska and in bringing me up. And I thank my father, mother, God for all the good that they have brought to me and for their love and dedication and help toward me in having a career and an education. I owe everything to them.
Well, thank you very much for the interview. Mm-hmm. I've enjoyed talking to you and hearing about all your experiences and that of
your
parents. And it's a reliving history.
Mm-hmm.